Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, how do Massachusetts voters feel right now about a November ballot question that could roll back a law regarding gender identity and public accommodations?
This is about safety for everyone in Massachusetts.
Also today, a conservative student at Mount Holyoke College says there's little political diversity on campus, and that's a problem.
When I did get to campus, there was a big culture shock. I really didn't understand the whole leftist bias on campus, and that's because I didn't have any experience. My family didn't have any experience with college.
Plus, the Longfellow Bridge is finally reopened.
I had the day off. I said, let's go walk the bridge, check it out. About time, and here we already got people vandalizing. Got a day long. That seems nice. It's about time.
And the famous or infamous marshmallow test. Do kids who can resist the pillowy treat really become more successful adults? That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we'll start today with a look at a Massachusetts ballot question that's getting some national attention. This November, voters will be asked whether the state should repeal a 2016 law that added gender identity to the list of groups that are protected from discrimination when using public accommodations such as bathrooms, locker rooms, restaurants, or other places open to the general public. Now, if the law were to be repealed, Massachusetts would become the first state in the country to repeal legal protections for transgender individuals. And we'll talk with representatives from both sides of this issue in just a moment. But first, a new WBUR poll conducted by the Mass Inc. Polling Group is giving us an initial look into how voters feel about the issue right now. And Steve Cazella is president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, and he joins us to go over the results. Hi there, Steve.
Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. So let's get right to the data. Specifically, first, what did you ask the folks that you polled, and what were some of the numbers that you got back?
Yes, we asked about the idea of repealing the law, repealing the transgender public accommodations law, and we found 38% would support the idea of repealing the law, 52% would oppose repealing the law. So just about 52% think that the law should stay on the books.
Okay. And so is that strong support and strong opposition on either side, or were a lot of the respondents sort of in the middle range of their support or opposition?
Yeah, I mean, we had more, I think, strong opposition than we had strong support. So about 4 in 10 say that they strongly opposed the idea of repeal. Only about a quarter said that they strongly supported the idea. You know, I think what we have to keep in mind here is that voters just haven't had as much time with this issue to really make up their minds. You know, this isn't something like same-sex marriage where we've been having the public debate about it for decades. It's been on the Massachusetts agenda for a long time, and voters have really had an opportunity to turn it over in their head. This is something where I would say public opinion is still fluid. We should still expect it to change going into the fall or even after the fall as well.
Interesting. So, and when you break down the respondents demographically, were there any significant patterns that jumped out to you?
Yeah, some interesting ones. I mean, I think, as you might expect, we found a partisan divide, with Democrats much more likely to oppose the idea of repeal, where Republicans were a bit more likely to support the idea of repeal. We also found a relationship to education. So that's one that actually has also become related to partisanship in recent years, where people with less education were more likely to support the idea of repealing the ballot question. When you get up to people with advanced degrees, you've got only 22% saying that they would like to repeal the law, 69% who would oppose it. So definitely a break on education as well.
22 to 69%. Wow. Okay. Interesting. And so finally, this is the first polling data we've seen on this ballot question. And as you said, you expect things to be more fluid as the summer progresses and we get into the fall. But given what you just said about the demographic breakdown and how partisan politics have become in America, how much more fluid do you think it could get?
Well, I mean, it's not to necessarily say that numbers will change, but I think what I'd say is that it's an issue where voters could be open to persuasion, or at least open to learning more about the issue and potentially changing their mind. You know, there's some other numbers from national polling which have shown, for instance, that only 37% of people know or are aware that they know someone who's transgendered. Only 13% of people know that have a close friend or family who's transgender. That's compared to 87% of people who know someone who's gay or lesbian. So again, as far as issues where that are often put together or often sort of put side by side, they really aren't in the same place as far as how much the public knows about them, how strongly they feel about them, and how much they know, you know, okay, I've got these values that I apply to many other things. This is how I should apply them to this issue, just because they really haven't had as much time to consider it.
Well, that's Steve Cazella. He's president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, walking us through some of the numbers from the new WBUR poll out today about how Massachusetts voters feel right now about a ballot question coming up in November that seeks to repeal a 2016 law on public accommodations and gender identity. Steve, thank you so very much.
Glad to do it.
And we should say, if you hop over to WBUR.org, you can see more coverage of the poll results from WBUR. Well, let's turn now to folks who sit on both sides of this issue. First of all, Yvette Olanda. She is the campaign director for Keep Massachusetts Safe. They are leading the charge to repeal the state's law. Yvette Olanda, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us today is Matt Wilder. He's spokesman for the Freedom for All Massachusetts campaign, and they want to keep the 2016 Massachusetts law on the book. Matt Wilder, welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you.
So, Yvette Olanda, let me just start with you. You heard the numbers that Steve Cazella gave to us. Most broadly speaking, 52% of voters currently oppose what you're trying to do, 38% support. What's your response to that, those initial numbers?
Well, I think just like you had, Mass Inc. said, there's a lot that people are open to about this. And we know that a lot of people don't know about this law, specifically this law in Massachusetts, separate from what the issue is. And that means that, we need to get out there and let people know what's going on and that this law actually is ripe for abuse because it was poorly written.
Okay, but so can I jump in here for a second? Sorry, as I knock my own microphone here. I mean, you said specific to what the law says versus the broader issue in Massachusetts. I'm not quite sure exactly how you tease those two apart because the law is designed to provide protections for transgender individuals.
So, yeah, I think what the issue is that there is a definition of gender identity is incredibly broad under this law. So it is how someone feels at that particular time. So at one point, they could be at home, feel as one gender, and tomorrow or even at work be another gender. So under that, it's self-identified. These are not people that have had any sort or under any kind of medical treatment necessarily or are necessarily, under any kind of treatment. And so when you have that, it's ripe for abuse with people that want to take advantage of that broad definition and prey on people in these spaces like locker rooms, restrooms, and fitting rooms.
Matt Wilder, let me get a response from you about what you just heard from Yvette Olanda.
Well, first of all, I would just say that I think Yvette makes a great point that people who don't know transgender people might think that. The truth of the matter is once you get to know and understand what being transgender is all about, you have a better appreciation for what that transition is like and what that journey is like. And certainly I think the transgender people that I know, I'm not transgender, but the ones that I know, want to just go about living their lives like everyone else, like you and I. And they want to be able to go to the mall. And they want to be able to go to the movies. And they want to be able to go to hotels and not feel discriminated against. Mm.
But that's not what our campaign is about. Our campaign is about safety for all citizens in Massachusetts. And because the broad definition of the law, somebody can stalk a woman in a restroom or a child in any of these accommodation places.
Do you have numbers on how, if that's happened in Massachusetts?
I have specific examples. I have very specific examples. In Plainville, there was a man a woman complained about a man in the restroom. It turned out he had been there for 30 minutes stalking her. She made a complaint to the security and they said, sorry, our store policy is we can't do anything because the policy followed under what the law would provide. And
so this
in
happened
Hanover,
after the law was passed?
Yes, this is within the last year. So, and then in Hanover, police arrested a man from the most from Massachusetts' most wanted list who stalked a woman and photographed her in a Target dressing room. Just was in the next to them to her stall and looked over and basically took pictures.
So let me just
Bellingham, another example.
Examples. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but in, it seems as if in each of those cases, though, someone felt unsafe and reported it to
and
someone.
And there was nothing that could be done because you could, it could be, under the law, it's considered harassment. If the person says, all you have to do is ask them, are you, you know, what is your gender? And whatever they, if they say that they are that gender that they identify with, then there's nothing that can be done because they are then harassed.
Matt Wilder?
Magna, first of all, a crime is a crime. And this law that's in place now doesn't change that. The rest of the story that Yvette doesn't tell you is that in Plainville, the man was actually arrested and charged and is going through the criminal justice system, as he should be. A crime is a crime. And this law that's in place, which has been in place now for almost 2 years, has really not changed that. Nothing has been diminished. It has made more people safe. It has made transgender people safe, who are often the targets of discrimination by people who don't understand what it means to be transgender. And so that's why this law is so important. It puts those protections in place. It allows people to go about living their lives just like we all want to.
Yvette, did you want to jump in here?
Sure. Yeah. I just wanted to say that everybody is vulnerable under and unsafe under this law, the way it is written. And if there's if people want to be protected, it's up to the legislature to write a better law so that everybody is protected.
So, I mean, what I'm about to ask something that's taking us beyond the purview of what's the November ballot question would be, but what specifically would you want changed in the law?
Well, for instance, that there could be a definition of, well, there were amendments made when this was being passed, and they to specifically the O'Connell Amendment that was going to prohibit sex offenders from being able to be exempted from this definition, and they specifically did not pass that amendment. So none of these amendments that were offered to protect people were taken up. And so it's the law, we can only repeal the whole law. We can't fix the things that we don't like about it. So it's up to the legislature to go and make sure that when this is repealed, they write something that protects everyone, all okay. vulnerable people.
Matt, let me ask you about that, because it sort of circles back to Yvette's initial point that her question committee takes issue with how broadly defined the law sees transgendered individuals. Just what's your response to that?
Well, I think at the core of this, what this law is really about is making transgender people in general just more inclusive and accepting and accepted in our society. And so I think that's what we have to really think about when we think about this law. Being transgender is a journey. We all understand that. And it's okay to not be as aware about it. That's okay. We're all learning. And I think this gives us an opportunity to do that and to understand what it means to be transgender, what that journey is like, particularly for young children. What kind of state do we want to be? Do we want to be a state that is really leading the charge on being a safe and accepting place? I think it's important to underscore something you said earlier. This will be the first vote in the nation by a statewide electorate to repeal protections, existing protections for transgender people. And this is going to send a signal to the country. If the opponents can win here, they will use that as momentum to roll back protections elsewhere.
Yvette, what do you think about that?
Again, I want to say that when there was an opportunity to make this law safe for everyone, they didn't take advantage of that. And that's why we have to repeal it. We need to go back to the drawing board and write up a law that will protect people and make people feel that they are accommodated and safe.
So if I may, I mean, I hear your argument about safety, but I have to say, I feel like over the course of U.S. history, we've heard a similar argument deployed, whenever discriminatory laws or practices were trying to be justified, like segregation was in part long
and that
kept
was targeted
in law
specifically at the protected group. We're not talking about the protected group in this.
Boogeyman of safety, though, is what keeps getting deployed. I mean, the president's talking about immigration, saying that like immigrants are all criminals and our neighborhoods are unsafe. I mean, it's sort of the same thing without sort of showing that like there are significant numbers of people who are behaving in unsafe ways. It's just, it's a kind of a blanket
argument.
Again,
it's about the law, how it's written. And that's why I say you have to separate it out from whatever the broader issue is. Because when you look at the, when someone does want to be protected, they have no recourse to protect themselves and therefore are victimized. Because again, the woman tried to make a complaint about this person who clearly was abusing the definition of the law. And there was nothing that could be done.
He was arrested. He was there for 30 minutes.
Yeah, and he still was there for 30 minutes, and he still was able to photograph her because he had access to do that.
Which is
a
crime.
That's the issue. Yeah, and that what gave him the access was the broad definition of this law, where he was there for 30 minutes. Had there been an ability to go to that criminal and say, you know what, you can't be here in this space, you are endangering someone, they couldn't do that because the store policy is that that would be found harassment under the law. So the store policy then is, it really intimidates people who want to protect themselves, the way it's written.
Well, I would just say, Meghna, you know, there are 18 other states in the country that have these protections. Massachusetts has now almost had these protections for 2 years. There are municipalities in the state that have had these for over a decade, Boston among them. And we have just not seen the picture that Yvette and Keep Mass Safe are trying to paint. And so I think
has been pointed out, if I could just finish, if you don't mind, is that
this is not real. There's really no data to back this up. There's one kind of tangential story, which in the end, the person was arrested as he should have been.
Mm. I gave three examples just in Massachusetts, and there are examples all over the place.
And in how many of those cases was the person arrested?
It doesn't matter if they're arrested, they're still a victim. So the thing is, we want to prevent crimes. It's the same as if you would bring up gun control. You want to not have guns.
No doubt about it. I think you and I agree on that. We want to prevent crimes. But nothing about this law, which is going to be on the ballot in November, would prevent those crimes. Those crimes would still happen.
The amendments that were offered were actually declined, which means then that that is the problem with the law.
I don't think the criminal is going to be looking at the amendments.
What about the times where transgender individuals feel unsafe because they have to use the bathroom that's opposite of their gender identity and they could be attacked, ridiculed, stalked, whatever?
Absolutely. And we want safety for everyone in Massachusetts. That's why it is up to the legislature to go back and fix this, because it doesn't protect the most vulnerable people.
But repealing this law does not do that.
Well, these are one of those situations where I don't want anyone to think that one person gets the last word over the other. So I'll have last word and say we will definitely return to this conversation, obviously multiple times between now and November, because obviously it's an important issue for many people in Massachusetts. So let me thank Yvette Olanda. She's campaign director for Keep Massachusetts Safe. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thanks.
And Matt Wilder, spokesman for the Freedom for All Massachusetts campaign, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And folks, send us a tweet at Radio Boston and let us know what you think about this ballot question. You're going to have to decide on it in November. Again, we're at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, good news. It has finally happened. After 5 years of construction and frustration, the Longfellow Bridge connecting Cambridge to Boston is open once again, fully. And so for the first time since 2013, Red Line trains for the MBTA, cars, pedestrians, cyclists, all of them will be able to cross the bridge in both directions. And Radio Boston producer-reporter Jamie Bologna is now standing on the Longfellow Bridge, and he joins me. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Meghna. And they're driving across and doing all that right now.
So exactly where are you, and what does it look like?
So I'm standing in the shadow of one of those massive salt and pepper shaker towers. And it looks beautiful. It looks like maybe the way it would have looked in 1907, except that, you know, Boston and Cambridge have sort of changed around it. But let me hear from Patricia Burcham, because I spoke to her earlier. She's from Wakefield, and let's hear what she says about what it looks like.
Absolutely gorgeous. I don't know what they did, like the railings here, and did they clean the salt and pepper? It's beautiful. I haven't been on this bridge in like forever, so it's pretty cool.
It is, and I agree. It is beautiful. And, you know, she came out here specifically today to see the bridge, and it looks clean and fresh and new, and here comes the tea. But, it looks like familiar, but also iconic at the same time.
As is the sound of the red line on the bridge. No, and I appreciate the fact that she's saying it's absolutely gorgeous looking at the railings and the way it was constructed, because the state and contractors took special care to repair and restore this historic bridge. And we're talking about that in a second, but that's partially the reason why the cost of the project added up to over $300 million. So tell us more about the work and what's changed.
Right. So as we were just saying, they replaced those railings. They're freshly painted to this bronze gold color, which I guess is the original color of them. Those salt and pepper shaker towers were taken apart. So all 529 granite pieces came off. They were cleaned and then they were put back together. And they look really great. In terms of the major infrastructure changes, there's one fewer lane going into Cambridge from Boston. Mm-hmm. So there used to be two going each way. Now there's one going from Boston to Cambridge, but there are two going from Cambridge into Boston. The pedestrian walkways are separated from the roadway with a metal and cement barrier. And then outside of that barrier on both sides of the bridge are these new bike lanes. And those lanes are separated from car traffic by, you know, you see them in other spots around the city, these sort of 4-inch around plastic poles that are attached to the pavement.
Right, and not to mention the sort of critical structural shoring up they did under the bridge as well.
Absolutely.
But, you know, Jamie, this project was supposed to be finished back in 2016, and I remember some folks saying, why is it taking so long to fully reopen this critical artery between, like, Kendall Square and the MGH complex on the other side? I mean, it was tough to have it closed so long. Why did it take 5 years to complete?
Well, so there are a number of reasons. One of them being that the bridge is a historic construction project. So it was put on the National Historic Register in 1976. And so it just took longer to reconstruct it in the way that would keep the bridge historically accurate and also using historically accurate construction methods, like rivets, for example, underneath in those metal archways which you see from the Charles River. The other reason it took so long was the shape that it was in when they started. I mean, Meghna, I think you know this very well. It was rusted totally through. Like, I remember seeing a video of you from 2007. You were standing on the Longfellow before the construction began, and you reached your hand into one of these iron railings, and you just pulled out a whole big chunk of flaky, crusted metal. And so that's partially, too, why it took so long. That's all been replaced. Although, I should note, it's not 100% done. I still see construction crews around and underneath it working. And that was something that, you know, folks here who I talked to were quick to point out to me. Like Joe Raffone from Newton. He said the construction has been frustrating.
It doesn't look fully open. It looks open, but they're still doing a lot of work. You know, I ride a bike around here. There's still a lot of... There's a lot of pedestrian stuff to be done still. You know, coming in to work in a car, there's lanes closed. The bridge is open, but everything around it is still chaotic.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what's left to be done, Jamie, and when can we expect that?
Well, it does seem like there was a mad dash to get it open this morning, especially since Governor Baker said back in February that he wanted it open by May. Today's the last day of May. You know, I was just walking along the bridge just a little while ago, and I saw a tube of caulking on the sidewalk here. And so there's just signs of the sort of rapid completion of the crews, you know, quickly getting out of here. Even these salt and pepper shaker towers, there's wires hanging out the side where I think lights are supposed to be attached. So there's more to be done. MassDOT says they expect to be finished completely by this winter. In terms of what's still to do, like Joe mentioned there in that previous clip, there are crews out here right now working on the roadways going in and out of the bridge. They're also working on a new pedestrian bridge on the Boston side of the Longfellow that would connect Charles Circle to the Esplanade over Star Drive.
Okay, and you know, you mentioned those bike lanes. There was some compromise on getting those the way they are. What'd you hear from cyclists?
Yeah, there was. So, you know, some cyclists before the bridge was completed wanted better and more protected bike lanes, and so these poles are sort of a compromise. And I spoke to a few cyclists, and they're optimistic. They seem to think that the plastic poles might be enough. One of them is Brenda Stanfield. She's from Cambridge, and she just crossed over on her bike in the bike lane, and she said that she's excited that both sides of the bridge are open, and she likes the new lanes.
I never really felt that's unsafe before, because I think cars are getting a lot more aware of bikes. There's a lot going in and out of Cambridge every day, so and I just think the design's great, and it looks beautiful, and it's a lovely addition to getting from Boston to Cambridge.
So I should say, if there's like one big takeaway here, Meghna, it's that even if it's not 100% done, the people I spoke to here on the bridge love how it looks. They're happy that it's finally open. And, you know, MassDOT says, like, before the project began, there were some 28,000 cars that crossed the bridge daily. But, I mean, you know, even as the city has changed so much in the past 5 years, from where I'm standing, it's 6 cranes on the horizon over in both Kendall Square and on the Boston side. So Boston is changing and growing, and traffic is getting heavier. So it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are on people and bikes and trains crossing the bridge in the future.
Well, that's Radio Boston producer-reporter Jamie Bologna speaking to us from the Longfellow Bridge. Jamie, wave hello to the sailboats for me, and thank you so much.
Okay, I will. Thanks, Meghna.
Thousands of graduates have been walking stages across the state this commencement season, hearing cheers and applause as they receive their diplomas. Earlier this month at Mount Holyoke College, Cassie Dillon heard cheers too, but there was something else. She also heard some boos from the crowd. Dillon is a Republican and the founder of LoneConservative.com, a conservative student media platform targeted at millennials. And she had decorated her graduation cap with Trump-Pence stickers, National Rifle Association, Republican elephant stickers, and other symbols. And after graduation, Dillon took to Twitter and wrote a widely read thread that described how being booed at her graduation was the latest in a long line of what she says were 4 years of challenging experiences at Mount Holyoke, where she says she was often ridiculed and bullied for her conservative views. For example, Dillon posted an April 2018 op-ed in the Mount Holyoke News that took issue with right-wing female speakers that Dillon had invited to campus. The student op-ed writer observed, quote, "The college Republicans appear ridiculous. They voluntarily join this predominantly liberal community and form a mean-spirited, minuscule, masturbatory circle of vitriol aimed at perceived liberal slights," end quote. But the op-ed, however, did go on to call conservative viewpoints a positive addition to on-campus culture and said, quote, "The maintenance of healthy debate is the prerogative of the entire community." And it's interesting because on that last point, Cassie Dillon agrees. But she says her experience at Mount Holyoke leads her to believe that a healthy debate is not happening on campuses right now. And Cassie Dillon joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about exactly what happened at commencement when you heard those boos?
Sure. So when I was going to receive my diploma, I was expecting people to be looking at me because I had, you know, some political messages on my cap. And so as I'm walking across the stage, I hear some booing and it shocked me and I was confused. I was expecting looks. I wasn't really expecting a boo because it's graduation and it's, you know, it's a pretty big deal for people. And so I accepted my diploma and I shook hands with our college president and I walked off. And as I'm walking off to walk around to go back to my seat, in my head, I'm like, did that really just happen? And then I sat down and my family had texted me and told me, wow, I can't believe that just happened. And then I talked to some professors who were there afterwards and they apologized to me.
So can we just step back in time a little bit and kind of start at the beginning of your experience at Mount Holyoke? Is it a place that you always wanted to go before you became a student?
I picked Mount Holyoke because it was awesome, and I thought it was a beautiful campus, and I didn't expect to get into politics when I got there.
You didn't expect to get into politics, but did you identify as a conservative even before you became a student there?
I thought I was a conservative because my grandfather would talk to me a lot about politics. He listened to Rush Limbaugh and all of that, but I didn't really understand exactly what conservatism was, but I felt like I could identify with my grandfather. And I was a big Rand Paul fan. But so when I went to Mount Holyoke, I had an open mind for sure. I called myself a Republican.
So you get to campus. And I just wonder,
your freshman year, like, sort of what were your expectations? Did you think at all that, you know, being a Republican or a student who had some conservative views would become so central to your experience?
Absolutely not. I really didn't understand the whole leftist bias on campus, and that's because I didn't have any experience. My family didn't have any experience with college. When I did get to campus, there was a big culture shock, and I enjoyed it. I was interacting with new people from all around the world. My roommate, my freshman year, she was from Kenya. I've never met anyone from Kenya before, so I thought that was really awesome, and I really loved how Mount Holyoke was so diverse and international. But then when I started taking classes, I definitely realized that conservatives were not only not welcome, but my professors just expected us to not be conservative.
Okay, so a couple questions there, if I could. So you said leftist bias. Specifically, what do you mean by that?
I mean that when you get into a classroom, your professors automatically assume that you aren't a conservative. So they'll make blanket statements that they just assume that you already agree with.
Did you ever speak up about that or say that you didn't agree? And what was the reaction?
I think the first time I spoke up was definitely in a history class where my professor made a statement about the Second Amendment saying that we're all interpreting wrong. It just means you can have a militia and that anyone that has an AR-15 only has the AR-15 so they could kill people, and that people who buy AR-15s are mentally ill. And I raised my hand and I said, look, my family has an AR-15 and none of us have ever killed anyone and we don't plan to and we're not mentally ill. I don't think we should be making these statements. And the professor at the time actually didn't combat what I said. She just stopped the discussion there and just went on with class.
Uh-huh.
She didn't even respond to me.
She didn't respond. Okay. But you weren't shut down, though. I mean, like, you were heard in that moment.
I was hurt in that moment. And definitely, I always think that my professors at Mount Holyoke have been really great to me. That's not the issue. The issue for me at Mount Holyoke has been the students.
Mm, okay, so then tell me more about your interactions with your fellow students then.
I have to say that the people who make general statements about me and you know, attribute all these horrible ideas to me have never met me before. They've never talked to me. But instead, they just attack me online or shout things to me as I'm walking to class or if I'm sitting at the dining hall. So most of these people just don't know me. And I, you know, I wish during my 4 years that a lot of these students would have asked to maybe get coffee and get to know me better.
Hmm. So, you know, what's interesting about that is I hear you saying that. And then I think, you know, if we took out the words conservative, right, and Trump and campus, exactly what you're saying, every single word that you're saying, I've heard, for example, African-Americans, Latino-Americans tell me that they wished that people would sit down with them and just get to know them and talk with them before, you know, shouting racial epithets to them on the street here in Boston, for example. So this call for just not making presumptions about folks and having conversations instead, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't like comparing the conservative issues in college campuses to the struggle of minorities. I think minorities get blanket statements made at them just because what they look like or what their race is or what language they speak. I think that's terrible. And I think the conservative side is, you know, they know who we are. It's a very small school. They know my beliefs. And so it's different. It's because I choose to believe those things and then people don't want to talk about it. So I think the minority struggle is definitely different and a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to get to the heart of whether or not your concern is with, like you said, is it with your fellow students or the institution of Mount Holyoke as a whole? Because, you know, the overlap there is pretty strong. Like the Mount Holyoke is trying to create an educational environment, positive educational environment for all its students. Do you think it's doing that successfully?
I don't think it's doing that, but I think Mount Holyoke definitely used me as being a student to show that they had political diversity. And I say that because they wrote an article about me my junior year, and they posted it very briefly. It made a lot of students upset, and they called it the courage to be right. And I think they used me as being a conservative student to show to their alumni and to prospective students that they do have ideological diversity. And just because I'm there doesn't mean necessarily they do. And I do think that the administration went out of their way to make sure that I was treated very nicely by them. And each time there was student issues going on with me, they would note it. But, I mean, there wasn't much they could do because a lot of these people, I didn't know who they were. They would just shout things at me as I'm walking to class.
Mm-hmm. In your thread, you talk about some specific circumstances or specific moments in your time at Mount Holyoke. And I was just wondering if we could go through one or two of them. For example, what happened after you voted for Donald Trump in 2016? You talk about in the thread how you were harassed after that. What happened?
So actually, I co-sponsored the viewing party with the College Democrats in our campus center. And I didn't really want to go to this event because, you know, I thought Donald Trump was going to lose. And I thought my peers would make fun of me and be like, haha, we told you so. And my peers weren't very hostile before the election. I mean, yes, there was some hostility, but it wasn't anything as nearly as bad as it was afterwards. And so I went to the event. And during the event, I'm standing up to go look at the screen because I was in the side of the room. I couldn't really see it. And people were screaming at me, sit your... you know, down, just shouting at me, saying you're a bigot, you're a racist, all of this stuff. Each time I'm just standing up to go look at the screen. And then after the event, as I'm walking home, which was really late at night, like 2 or 3 in the morning after they were about to call it, I had people screaming at me. And then the next day, a lot of students didn't go to class. And as I'm walking to class, I'm getting people screaming at me. People are posting things on an old forum called Yik Yak, which isn't in operation anymore, but it's an anonymous app that people would use. And people were threatening me, saying they wanted to beat me up. Can I punch her in the face? Saying things like that, and then tweeting at me. And so there's a lot of online harassment.
Did you reach out for help to Mount Holyoke?
Yeah, I definitely told my deans, but there was nothing that they could really do. There was a few people online who used their real name that were talked to and told to stop. But the problem with that was I definitely have thick skin. It didn't upset me. I mean, it was very upsetting, but I just kind of went through it like, okay, well, these people are being insensitive and they're being rude, but I can get through it. But it was when they started harassing my friends for being my friends that really actually got under my skin and actually upset me.
So I guess, I keep kind of asking the same question in a multiplicity of ways, but I'm really trying to get to understand better. Like, I get it that you have thick skin, but did things escalate ever to a point, say, with your friends, where you were concerned and you went to Mount Holyoke, to the deans there, and did you ever request any action be taken?
I had several meetings with the deans, and like I said, the deans didn't really know what they could do about it because a lot of it was anonymous. But the deans always reached out and said, if you need any support, we're here for you, we can help you. But again, there's not much they can do. But during that time, after the election, a lot of colleges across the campus, or across the nation, including mine, were sending out emails telling students, hey, we have these resources if you need it, we're going to fight anti-racism and all of this stuff. But never did they include political ideology. So they have all these new standards talking about, hey, if you break any of these rules, if you be hateful towards any of these groups, we're going to take action. And I don't, like I said earlier, I don't think being conservative is definitely in the same league as, you know, getting racism towards you. But I think they should have stressed more in the campus-wide emails. And then they also had a hate bias form. They should have definitely included in there that you shouldn't be making fun of students because of what political party they're in.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is so much ugliness in American politics right now. And to be honest with you, Cassie, I think some of the ugliest stuff comes from President Trump. I mean, you said that you had originally supported Carly Fiorina in the Republican primaries. I mean, do you remember when then-candidate Trump, you know, was making really terrible comments about Fiorina's appearance, you know, saying, look at that face, would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that being the face of our next president? I mean, really, folks, come on, are we serious? I mean, do you remember that?
I absolutely remember that. Yeah. And that really upset me. I didn't like Trump at all during the beginning of the primaries. I thought he was crazy. I remember the first time I listened to one of his speeches, I was like, what is this guy even talking about? But when I got closer to where I realized that he was getting the nomination, honestly, I picked the better of two evils. And I was hoping that Trump would, you know, elect or nominate a really conservative Supreme Court justice. And I was hoping that he would be pro-Israel. And he did for those two things. So I got everything I wanted for my vote. And I don't think it's going as bad as most people thought it would.
I suppose there's a lot of debate over that. I mean, the reason why I asked you that question is, how do you think we can move forward as a nation to have better conversations with each other if the the president of the United States very frequently is the source of some of the ugliest and most hateful language and rhetoric on, you know, a daily, if not a weekly, if not daily basis.
Well, yeah, I do think that he says some things that are definitely rude, but I think that he gets a lot of hate as well. So I think it's hate versus hate, and I think that everyone needs to settle down a little bit and try to have real conversation. And I think the difference with that and what happened to me is that people know that Trump is saying these things, and people know that people are saying things about Trump. A lot of people don't know what college conservatives go through, and my whole thing is I'm not trying to be a victim. I don't want people to feel sorry for me, but I do want to share my story and let people know that this is happening, especially for college students who are conservative that are about to go to college, or even their parents to know what's going on.
Yeah. So how would you describe what your conservative values are today?
That's the loaded question.
I don't mean it to be loaded.
I know.
Yeah, I suppose I should have asked you that earlier, right? But when you describe yourself as a conservative, what exactly are you saying?
The main thing for me is free speech. And I think we're seeing a lot of issues with that lately. People interpreting it wrong and thinking free speech means you're free from repercussions too. And that's just not the case. And then I'm also very fiscally conservative. So when the Trump administration is putting tariffs out, I really dislike them trying to be against free trade. So that's definitely a criticism I have of the Trump administration. I'm also pro-life, and I am very pro-Israel. So I'm really happy with some of the things the administration has been doing for my values. But obviously, there's a lot more than just those issues that are important to me.
A lot more. So give me a couple more things.
I want criminal justice reform, which is something that I agree with my peers a lot on, especially on campus. I'm not hugely pro-marijuana, but I do think that marijuana should be decriminalized in states. I think that would help a lot with prison issues we're having. There's a lot of different topics, and I'm kind of at a loss for words.
Yeah, I know.
There's a lot.
Tell me everything.
I can tell you my thinkers that I definitely look up to.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Ben Shapiro, he's definitely somebody I look up to. I look up to Rand Paul. And then my number one idol in person, I can't wait to see president one day because I'm convinced she will be, is Nikki Haley.
Current UN ambassador. So to get back to your campus experience, I mean, what advice would you have for colleges and universities around the country about the experience that conservative students have on campus?
I think they should try making their colleges have more ideological debate and diversity. The editorial board at the Harvard Crimson actually just put out an editorial saying that they should have more conservative professors being hired because it would help them get a better education. And I think it's really telling that the conservative, or that just students, and they're not conservative, students in general pushing that, I think that's really telling that they're doing it and the administration isn't. So in my advice to colleges is you should try promoting ideological diversity because college is an island and you're supposed to be preparing these students to go out in the real world.
Well, Cassie Dillon is a member of the Mount Holyoke Class of 2018, and she's also founder of LoneConservative.com. Cassie, it was very, very good to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Marshmallow, for you. You can either wait, and I'll give you another one if you wait, or you can eat it now.
Well, that's a version of the marshmallow test, one of the most famous experiments in child psychology and one that's had a wide impact beyond the Stanford University lab, where it was first conducted in the 1960s. That's when psychologist Walter Michel first tested more than 500 preschoolers, giving them the choice to immediately eat a marshmallow or wait and then get two. The point being that delayed gratification, self-control, grit. Michelle reported that the kids who were able to say no to the mallow ended up being more successful adults with higher SAT scores, lower body mass indices, and more control over their emotions. Now, the marshmallow test is controversial, and in recent years, its findings are not exactly replicable. For example, just this month, in the journal Psychological Science, researchers published a study where they concluded that the results of the marshmallow test have little to no statistically significant impact on later life outcomes.
Well, joining us now is the researcher who led this study, Tyler Watts. He's an assistant professor of research at New York University. He had two co-authors on the paper. Professor Watts, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, why did you first want to question the results of the original marshmallow experiment?
Yeah, well, you know, I was a psychology student in undergraduate, when I was an undergraduate student, and I, you know, was really interested in these studies when I first saw them. I still remember seeing the videos, just like the audio clip that you played a few minutes ago, and they've always been really interesting to me. And my co-authors and I do sort of work on educational policy, where we try to figure out, you know, what kinds of skills and competencies should programs and interventions be investing in. And the hope is if you invest in a program early on, that it will teach kids something that will then have sort of a lifelong impact. And so it seemed like, you know, the marshmallow test and delay of gratification is something that people continually go back to, they continually talk about. So it seemed like it was worth revisiting.
Right. I mean, in fact, this is something that is central to a lot of the education or social-emotional education that young kids are getting in some schools these days. So it has a very powerful effect on what people think are determining factors for later life outcomes. But when did you replicate the test exactly, or did you make any changes, and what did you find?
Yeah, sure. So we should first say we didn't actually do the test ourselves. This was a data set that was funded by NIH. Kids were recruited in the early 90s, and developmental psychologists put together this really great data set where they were tracking about 1,000 kids over time. So I think, as far as I know, the kids are still being tracked into adulthood. And they gave the marshmallow test at age 4. And one key difference with the test that they gave was they stopped the test after 7 minutes. So if a kid waited for 7 minutes, then the test was over and they got the second marshmallow. So some of the original tests went longer. So that posed a little bit of an analytic challenge to us, which we can get into in a minute. It didn't end up being as big a factor as we thought. And then what we did was we just simply followed up at the age 15 wave, and we looked at statistically, did the kids who waited longer at age 4, did they have higher achievement scores in math and reading at age 15? And then we also looked at a bunch of behavioral outcomes, like risky behavior in adolescence.
Yeah. Now, Professor Watts, I have to tell you, there are maybe thousands of parents right now listening on the edge of their seats. What did you find? What's the bottom line?
So basically what we found was we found really no relationship between waiting and later behavioral outcomes, which we were surprised to see. And for achievement, we found a much smaller positive relationship than what Michelle and his colleagues originally reported. And the key thing for us was that when we statistically controlled for background characteristics of the kids, so we controlled for their race and ethnicity, gender, stuff about their parenting environment, their home environment, when we controlled for all of that, then the relationship became pretty much insignificant at that point.
So this is one of the major criticisms of Michelle's initial studies. Did he do those same controls when reporting his results?
No. And to be fair, when he was publishing that work, few people did. Our computing power and our understanding of how statistics works has come a long way since then. So that was part of why we did this, was we thought, you know, we should really go back and test. If you kind of hold stuff constant about a kid, then does the difference in being able to delay gratification really matter? And we found that it didn't matter very much.
But I'm looking at, let me see if I can find it. I've got the paper in front of me. I'm looking at one of the charts that you have here. Here it is. Yeah. Minutes waited on delay of gratification task. That's on the x-axis. And on the y-axis, you have achievement score at age 15. Between 0 minutes and, like, what is that, 1 minute, there does, even with the, when you applied your controls, there does seem to be a jump in achievement score at age 15.
Yeah, there is. There's about a tenth of a standard deviation, which is not huge, but it is something. And that's when we control for kind of normal background characteristics. And what's interesting is that most of that benefit is gained by just being able to wait about 20 seconds. So actually being able to wait 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 5, 6, 7 didn't really have much extra benefit on top, which we were surprised to see. And then actually when you control for other stuff about the kid measured at age 4, like their math achievement, their reading achievement, and behavioral problems, then the relationship is basically zero or indistinguishable from zero, which means that if you were to sort of tune up delay of gratification, but you didn't change broader cognitive skills in the kids or behavioral skills in the kids, you wouldn't expect to see long-term effects based on our results.
Okay. So in that case, is the whole marshmallow test, I mean, people have been saying this now, but now we have your newly analyzed data set. Is the whole test moot?
No, I actually don't think so at all.
Okay.
So I think, you know, that first of all, I think we have to keep in mind that when Michelle was first doing this work, it was really pretty much, you know, pioneering work. And it really has taught us a lot about the way that kids think and what kids are capable of doing at a very young age. So I still think the test is really, you know, it's really interesting for sort of analyzing how kids delay gratification, right? And what's going on in their minds at such a sort of interesting age. The question for us was, does being able to delay gratification at age four, does that really matter for your sort of long-term life trajectory? And that's where I think we kind of, you know, walk back some of the conclusions that were originally made.
Yeah. And this isn't the first time that Michelle's original studies have been challenged, right? Because I think a lot of people have asked questions over time about so many things can alter a child's response to the marshmallow test. Like, are they more likely to respond to folks in authority, peer pressure, things like that? There have been other sort of challenges before. We just got about 10 seconds here. Sorry to rush you through your last answer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so our study, I think, just adds a new layer of complexity to what we already know.
Okay, so for all those parents who were thinking about grabbing a marshmallow and putting it under their kids, just enjoy the mellow instead with your kid, right?
Exactly.
Maybe being a parent rather than testing your kid is, I'm telling this to myself, is most important. Tyler Watts is an assistant professor of research at New York University. He's author of a new paper that's testing the marshmallow test, and we've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Professor Watts, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.